This is Art in Focus, brought to you by the McMullen Museum of Art at Boston College. My name is Megan Minahan, class of 2022, and a McMullen student ambassador. I'd like to welcome you in listening to an episode in our series on the exhibition Martin Parr, Time and Place. This episode will feature a conversation between Monsignor Liam Burgeon and the director of the Faith, Peace, and Justice minor, Professor Joshua Snyder.
My name is Liam Burgeon. I'm a Catholic priest from Ireland, and I am a professor of theology at Boston College. I'm glad to be joined in this conversation today by my colleague Joshua Snyder, who also teaches in the theology department, and he will introduce himself in a moment. I have been 11 years at Boston College. Before that, I was a seminary rector at the Pontifical Irish College in Rome, where I spent 24 years in all. So I joke I'm only Irish on the outside, I'm Italian on the inside. And because I'm a priest at BC, people accuse me of being a Jesuit. And in my defense, I joke that I am not a Jesuit, that I am normal. Anyway, my area of interest is sacramental theology and the way that ritual, religious and non-religious ritual, shapes us as individuals and as a community. And recently, I've become interested in the relationship between ecology and worship, as encouraged by Pope Francis and his wonderful letter Laudato Si on the environment. We Catholics use created realities, water, bread, wine, oil, to mediate and encounter the divine. And so does this religious liturgical use of these elements, does it influence our relationship with the environment? And I believe it does. Just last week, I was happy to have an article published called Saving Water, and the pun was intended. So it talks about the water that saves, but also about our responsibility as people who use water to care for water. Also, I'm working on a book, An Introduction to Catholicism. This term, I taught a class called Sacraments and Art, and the students and I had a wonderful docent-directed visit to the exhibition at the McMullen.
Hello, I'm Joshua Snyder. I'm an assistant professor of the practice and theological ethics here at Boston College within the theology department. I began teaching here in 2018, and I also direct the Faith, Peace, and Justice minor. My main areas of research focus on transitional justice and Catholic peace building, with a particular focus on the Guatemalan Catholic Church and human rights. Additionally, I am interested in Catholic social teaching and its contribution to global public health, with a special focus on the ethics of accompaniment and end-of-life care. I just finished an article on COVID-19, Global Public Health and the Common Good, which will be coming out this summer in the Journal of Catholic Social Thought. Here at BC, I typically teach Pulse, which many of you might know, is the introductory course in theology and philosophy with an experiential learning component, as well as I teach the challenge of justice and the challenge of peace, both of which are theology and philosophy courses that are intended for the Faith, Peace, and Justice minor. In terms of thinking about the exhibit, there are two big questions that Parr's work really raises for me as a theological ethicist. First question involves the evolving or waning influence of the Catholic Church as an institution within Ireland. The second is a question about economic justice, and particularly raising questions about consumption and its impact on the natural environment.
Martin Parr, as you know, was born in 1952. I was born in 1959. And the work, if you like, the works in this exhibition, Time and Space, range from 1975 to 2019. They're almost, if you like, a companion or a vade mecum to my own lifespan. The photograph that I have chosen to reflect on is entitled The Pope Gives Mass, Phoenix Park, Dublin, 1979. And I simply had to choose that one. Why? Because I was there. Before we talk about that, I think it's important just a little bit of background. John Paul II made 104 international trips during his pontificate. The first was to Mexico, where he attended the wonderful meeting of the South American bishops, or the Latin American bishops, in Puebla. And it had an important impact, indeed, in terms of the church's social teaching and social outreach. The second visit was to his home in Poland. And the third was to Ireland, September 29th to October 1st, 1979. And indeed, when he finished in Ireland, he took a flight directly from Shannon to Boston. But it was an extraordinary proud moment for Ireland that the Pope would give precedence and decide to visit this small Catholic nation on the fringes of Europe. Two-thirds of the Irish population saw the Pope during those 3 days. 1.2 million people attended the Mass in Phoenix Park on the very first day of his visit. Anyway, this photograph is black and white, as much of Parr's early work is. It depicts the scene as worshippers gather for the Mass with the Pope. They had walked a considerable distance already through the night, and now they are making their way up a gentle hill in the early morning as the sun rises. There are young and old, mostly dressed in coats and scarves and hats, as the Irish weather would demand. They carry bags in their hands, which probably had fold-up chairs, and some food for the long wait until the Mass would start. Parr stated that his work is a study of the local, and I see that in this photograph.
So just to offer a couple of quick comments on the photograph before I talk more about why Parr's work is of interest to me, is that in looking at the faithful that early autumn morning, the photograph itself really gives the sense of a solemn procession. And in a real way, I feel this sense of pilgrimage as the faithful make their way, as Liam said, up that softly rolling hill at first, as the light is just beginning to break that morning. And I think it has, that profound sense of reverence. And also, for me, what was very palpable in looking at the photo initially was the sense of spirituality and the connection between the natural environment. I know this is something that's very of interest to Liam, the natural environment and how that has a liturgical impact for us. So one of the questions I had, and Liam, maybe you can get to this later on, is how you see that playing out in this experience, given that you were there as well, but how the open air Mass and that impact of just the beautiful natural environment of Ireland plays into the setting of our photo that we're looking at.
Josh, you use the word pilgrim, and that was exactly what I saw when I looked at this photograph. It's almost like a meandering pilgrimage of people coming up this hill. And the sun is rising in the background, and it casts long shadows, if you like, on the walking pilgrims. You know the difference between a pilgrim and a tourist, of course. Simply, pilgrims cannot complain. Okay, tourists often do, pilgrims can't. And I think that there is that wonderful, as you said, reverence in the group as they walk. And it's interesting that the sun is rising behind and it casts shadows across the pilgrims. And that east-west axis has an enduring significance in ritual and in sacraments. And it's not uncommon indeed for many churches to have an east-west orientation. So these pilgrims are emerging from the east, emerging from the light on their way to this Mass. And there's, I think, looking at the picture there, there's a wonderful sense of comradeship and communion. They were all in that kind of, we're all in this together mood. And that's what happens on pilgrimages. Normal structures are overcome, titles are left aside, if you like. There's a loss of the self and ego boundaries, a powerful sense of at oneness with nature, with those around, and an awakening of the transcendent dimension that surrounds us all. And that surely the true goal of pilgrimage is our sense of fellowship strengthened, our perception of things is broadened, and our awareness of mystery is deepened. Our identity is renewed, and even our wounds are healed. So as I watch that procession of people, I see much of that.
Beautiful. Maybe, Liam, I could ask you a couple of questions that I was really interested in, given that you were actually there for the Mass. Maybe it would not be inappropriate for me to, get some of your own personal feelings. Again, given, the photo itself gives us this profound sense of pilgrimage, of intense spirituality. Did you feel the same in being there? What was it like? I've seen other photos of this Mass, and there's, as you pointed out, 1.2 million faithful attending the Mass of the Pope. That to me, like thinking of a crowd that big, I think of something like Woodstock. And was this like a Catholic Woodstock? What was the mood like? I know, like we're talking about, sort of the solemn nature and the pilgrimage, but was there joy as well? How would you characterize some of that experience being there firsthand?
It was an extraordinary event, really. I mean, kind of Americans will always say, where were you when you heard the news of JFK assassination? Or where were you on 9/11? And again, Irish people, when they talk, will say, with whom did you go to the Mass in Phoenix Park? Where did you stay the night before? Because people, were traveling, from very early morning, all that kind of thing. So it's absolutely carved or etched on our memory. And it was a wonderful, joyous occasion. I remember when we were all there waiting for the Pope to come. And this was the very first event in the Pope's schedule. And as he was arriving in Dublin, they decided to bring the airplane carrying the Pope on a low flight over the park, where he could see the 1.2 million people there. And everybody got up and cheered and clapped and sang and waved papal flags and Irish flags. It was an extraordinary celebration. And if I can tell you, I was in my cassock, wearing my black cassock, because I was going to be distributing Holy Communion to the crowds. And I sat down after the Pope's plane had gone over, and I sat down on an orange that was in my pocket. So an abiding memory for me of that day is having fresh orange juice on my leg.
Liam, one more quick question, and then I'd like to add some insights. But in the photo itself, I've noticed that everyone has like a little badge or pin on. Can you tell me what that was, and do you remember wearing that?
It was to guide you to the area of the park where you were going to be. So everybody had, for this huge crowd, you were being guided to different sections, and that's what people are wearing. That's if my memory serves me correctly.
Wonderful, wonderful. So, I mean, we kind of talked on this, but one of the things that really drew me within the photo was just the size of the crowd. And as I mentioned earlier on, as a theological ethicist, one of the questions that I'm really interested in is sort of the role of the institutional Catholic Church in Ireland and how that has changed and been challenged. And I think Pars, makes some of those insights available to us in his work. And one of the things that really struck me is, as you said, there were 1.2 million of the faithful attending that first Mass. And I believe over 2.5 million were at one of the events of the Pope during his visit in 1979. But if we juxtapose this to the most recent visit of Pope Francis in August of 2018, I think the estimated crowds there were only 82,000. And to me, I think that demonstrates, some serious ethical considerations to think about the role that the Catholic Church has had influencing culture within Ireland, and how some of the challenges that have emerged in Ireland, thinking of things like the clergy sex abuse scandal, some of the homes for unwed mothers, and the most recent debates that have occurred about the legalization of abortion, to really raise questions about the role of the Catholic Church in Ireland, and how that continues to influence the culture. So as an ethicist, that to me was really something that I was drawn to in the photo itself, thinking about the numbers and thinking about the sort of joyous expectation for the Pope's arrival. And then, you know, over the last 40 years, how some of that joy or that hope within the church might be changing. So that's just something that really was on my mind as I reflected on this particular work of ours.
And they're great comments, Josh. And again, Parr, he has one of his books about Ireland, of his photographs on Ireland, is called From the Pope to a Flat White. And flat white being a coffee, kind of something like a cappuccino, as you know. But anyway, Ireland gained independence from England in 1922. And Catholicism was an important factor in determining our national identity. The Vatican was the first power to recognise the Irish Free State, followed indeed closely by the United States. So Catholic worship, Catholic sacraments, Catholic devotion, all of these were to shape the nation very, very definitely. And as you know from your own work, Josh, ritual is a powerful thing. Ritual has the power to hold us captive and the power to set us free. It has the power to feed our minds and hearts, to nurture body and soul, to cultivate our conscience and imagination. And ritual also, unfortunately, has the power to stifle, the power to disable, and the power to cut us off. And so I think, you know, the young Irish state and its link with Catholicism did both of those things. The Catholic devotion and culture, you know, gave rise to innumerable lay and religious missionaries who went all over the world. And, St. Patrick's Day is a national holiday in Nigeria because of the number of Irish missionaries that went there. So, teachers, nurses, doctors, agricultural workers, they were inspired by the Catholic ethos and the Catholic culture to do these things. And something that I think is greatly ignored today is that artists, poets, playwrights, musicians, they too emerged from the Catholic culture, particularly of the earlier part of the 20th century. Certainly things have changed, okay? And again, you listed some awful scars on the Irish soul, how single mothers were treated, the Magdalen laundries, where kind of almost women who had babies out of wedlock were just hidden away. And there were other moments like that were a great, great tragedy. And where, if you like, you think that our Catholic ritual and Catholic practices would have, if you like, helped us to deal with these things as opposed to smooth over them. Yes, when Pope Francis came to Ireland in 2017, it was a smaller crowd. But you know, I think it was a more real and a more honest group. There was so instead of having a mass for 1.2 million people in the public park, it was in a football stadium, about 85,000 people there. And it was the mass for, it was actually a vigil liturgy for the World Day of Families. And immediately we saw diversity. Diversity, you know, kind of the new Irish, people who have come to our shores to find a new life there, they were represented. People that we had hidden before. In Ireland, we have a group called Travellers. They are mistakenly called Gypsies, but they are an ethnic group and they have suffered much, if you like, social exclusion and great prejudice. Their presence was highlighted at this mass. There was a family from Mosul in Iraq who had to leave their homes and go to Australia. And they were returning to Iraq because of peace was returning to the country. And they appeared on the stage. I was watching this by TV from Boston, and they appeared on the stage and I nearly died because their son was a student of mine in Rome. He was ordained a priest and he was martyred in Mosul in 2007. His name is Rachid Ghani, a wonderful martyr. But anyway, the gathering was smaller. But so it was quantitatively different, but qualitatively as well. I think it kind of touched on, you know, kind of the new Ireland and its, you know, kind of the economic and cultural changes that have happened. But I like to think it was more honest, it was more real, it was more inclusive, it was more compassionate.
That really gives us a lot of food for thought. Thank you, Liam, for those great insights of the comparison of those two different liturgies, and particularly thinking of the size of them. Going back to the photograph before us, you know, Phoenix Park in 1979, one of the things that I did is I wanted to look up Pope John Paul's homily for that day. And I found this really interesting. If anyone is interested, you can just go to the Vatican website and you could read the homily for that day. But one of the things that Pope John Paul II brings up as a warning is questions about modernism and its impact on consumerism. Pope John Paul II really you know, praises the Irish for their spirituality, praises the Irish for their sense of sacramentality. But about two-thirds into his homily for that day, presents us with a stark warning about challenges of consumerism. And that really stood out to me because I think it echoes, particularly within this exhibit, some of the other work that our Parr presents us with. So, you know, some of the words from the homily that John Paul II offered that really raised my interest, where he states, "The pervading materialism imposes its dominion on humans today in many different forms and with an aggressiveness that spares no one. Many people now are tempted to self-indulgence and consumerism at the expense of human dignity. And this can create a false pretense concerning freedom and the sacredness of life that leads us away from some of those more authentic values regarding the common good." And for me, this was interesting because as you walk through the exhibit and you move from some of those, you know, religious images to other sections of the exhibit, I think Parr does a great job of highlighting concerns about the middle class and brings us with some really ethical questions about consumptive habits and capitalism, what capitalism encourages. And in particular, I was thinking about Schoholm's Dublin, 1986, and Buying Good Stuff. In these two photographs by Parr, he demonstrates, particularly in Schoholm's, you have this beautiful photo, and it's, you know, in front of the house, it says, "Four-bedroom showroom," right? And then in Inishmore, in the part of the exhibit on Buying Good Stuff, you see the juxtaposition of a mega yacht in the background and a small horse and buggy in the forefront. And, you know, looking at these and thinking about the questions that in my mind were presented by the homily, I think Parr takes us on this theological journey within his work to, you know, ask questions about, you know, what are the economic concerns and what are the economic implications of consumerism in a late capitalist society? And also we see this in some of the elements of his exhibit, you know, in the section of the exhibit entitled Abandonment, where Parr demonstrates this through the images of discarded cars as sort of the new Irish ruins, right? We see decaying metal surrounded by the beautiful natural environment. And for me, besides, you know, the insights that John Paul II brought up about consumerism and its impact on human dignity, this brought to mind Pope Francis and Francis's concerns with the environment and what he calls throwaway culture. This sort of pervasive tendency within modern culture to, you know, want the newest things, and anything that's sort of lost its use value ought to be discarded. And I thought that was very profoundly presented in Parr's images of, you know, sort of these Morris Minor cars deteriorating, you know, right in the natural environment. And we see decaying metal surrounded by the beauty of nature. So for me, you know, as an ethicist, I thought it was very interesting to try to draw some of these parallels, both between the questions that John Paul II presented in his homily and where the exhibit leads us as we move from, you know, sort of these beautiful images of the sacramentality of nature to raising questions about middle class consumption and the decay that we see with, as these cars no longer served value, they sort of just disappear. So those were some of the other questions that came to my mind as well as I, you know, walked through the exhibit and, you know, tried to put on my hat as a theologian and an ethicist.
And of course, I know of your great interest in justice and peace. And so as John Paul's homily was, if you like, prophetic in the sense of, you know, warning us about the dangers of consumption, consumerism, he also, during that visit, he could not go to Northern Ireland. It was politically impossible. But one of the gatherings he had was a mass just south of the border, in the Irish Republic and south of the border. And this is 1979, he made an extraordinary appeal for peace. And the lines, you know, kind of that were just etched on all of our minds was, "On my knees, I beg you, leave down your arms." OK, so that this great appeal. It didn't happen until 1998 that we had the Good Friday Agreement and a kind of a structured path towards peace. But I've no doubt but that, you know, John Paul's appeal 19 years earlier was significant in all of that.
What really just came to my mind as you said this, and I hadn't even thought of it, but relating that to our current moment with, you know, what's happening in the Ukraine and the appeals of both Pope Francis and his appeal for peace, the consecration of Ukraine and the Russian Federation to the Sacred Heart of Mary that occurred last Friday, you know, the profound role that the Pope can play in being a peace builder within the world. You know, and really highlighting the importance, which is, for me, hugely important, the positive role of the Catholic Church as an agent of social change within civil society. And as you mentioned, we have John Paul II as a peace builder and Pope Francis really taking on that role today. And hopefully we can see the Ukrainian Catholic bishops, you know, and their urgent appeals for peace within the Ukraine today, maybe that we can see some of that bearing good fruit as well.
Truly, and while the Catholic Church can't command armies or it can't, you know, influence in that particular way, this exhibition too reminds us of the power of the symbolic. Symbolic actions are important. They impact and they change. I mean, the one that's in this Ukrainian crisis that sticks with me is the image of Pope Francis getting into his small Fiat car and being driven to the Ukrainian embassy to speak with the ambassador. And I saw one American commentator, she said, you know, kind of, it was an empty gesture. I don't agree. I think it was powerful and it was better than nothing. Okay. And Pope Francis is just prophetic actions, kind of trying to herald a different world order by the things that he says and does, and to raise our own hopes, our own expectations to something greater. And I believe that's, you know, kind of, as a sacramental theologian, I think that's really, really important. There's a wonderful image from an Old Testament biblical scholar said that for the Hebrew, they proceed through time like a rower, like somebody rowing a boat who moves into the future backwards. We reach our goal by taking our bearings from what is visibly in front of us, and that is the past, if you like. So the rower goes backwards into the future with the past behind. And I think that's a good image for all of us, and particularly as we reflect on this photograph of the Pope in Ireland. We cannot be locked into the past. No. Good ritual, good religion calls us to have a responsibility for one another, to realize that, again, back to our pilgrim image, there are no strangers, but we are all fellow pilgrims together. And so it gives us, as we gaze on the past, we are not held by it, but we from it we gain, if you like, the coordinates for our present and our future in that. And again, I'd like to believe that good ritual, good sacraments, good worship do that. I'm sure you have will argue on that with ethics as well.
Absolutely. That was a really great segue for, to think about questions of how theological ethics can help us to, reflect on the work of Parr. A couple of things that I think were really helpful for me in trying to think through his work in the exhibit were, first, the connection or the interconnection between aesthetics and justice. When we think of questions about beauty, for me, that's just intrinsically linked to questions of justice. We see this within the work of Plato as well. We see this in a lot of theological reflection on aesthetics, that the work of public art can call us to questions about justice and what we owe our neighbor. So for me, in seeing the work of Parr, that really raised questions that I wanted to reflect on in terms of the connection of beauty and justice. And he also brings in whimsy. I love the humor that's involved in his work as well. We may not see it in this particular piece that we're focusing on for today, but I welcome everyone else to go and see the exhibit, because there's just humor and love of life that you see. And I think that, brings up questions about, what we deem beautiful. And then if we deem this to be beautiful, what do we owe our neighbor as a matter of justice? What are the ethical implications of Parr's work? Two other questions that came to me, or two other concerns from my own academic discipline that helped me to think about this, would be the importance of the place-based approach to universal questions. So the questions that Parr grapples with in his photographs are universal, right? These aren't things that are only connected to those who are from Irish descent, but rather they raise perennial questions about human nature, what is the good life in community. But he does it in such a way that he's very attentive to the particular, the local, and the importance of the local and, coming to understand the meaning of these perennial questions. So I really appreciate that, because my own work on peace, justice, and reconciliation always focuses on the uniqueness of a given situation. You had mentioned before, as the Troubles came to an end with the formal agreement in 1998, what was going to work in Ireland may not be the same that would work in what we saw in 1992 in Rwanda. So being attentive to the geographic location and the importance of place, I think, is something that Parr's work really, invites us to do and consider. And in so doing, and looking at the uniqueness of the local, it raises those universal questions. And then one other, final insight I would say that Parr's work made me reflect on in terms of being a theological ethicist is the importance of narrative truth. I felt that Parr is a wonderful storyteller, and the medium in which he does that is photography. But he tells the story of Ireland over the past of 40 years, and for me this really is important, because oftentimes in modern society we get so focused on sort of a forensic vision of the truth. What are the facts? What can I point to that is factual? And I think narrative truth is a much more robust vision of what truth is. It looks to the experience of human beings, and it invites us to reflect on that experience and be drawn into the world in a way that, simply, trying to pick up a newspaper and look for, quantitative data won't really do. But this also raises questions about the ethics of storytelling. How can we tell the story of another person in a way that's truthful, respectful, and ethical? And I think, Parr does that beautifully. And The fact that, Liam, you were there for this Mass and, you know, your own experience, to me, really resonated nicely with what I saw in that photograph of, you know, the pilgrimage on the way to Phoenix Park. I think is a testimony to Parr's ability to convey narrative truth in a way that's respectful and ethical.
Just your comment there about the relationship between art and social justice. Goodness, with a class recently, we read the letter that Pope John Paul II, again, John Paul II, addressed to artists in 1999. And again, it was before the year 2000, the Great Jubilee, as he called it. And again, he talks about the relationship between art, social justice, again, beauty and truth, the transcendental properties, you know, how they are all interlinked. And again, too, I loved what you said there, Josh, about, you know, kind of the particular and the universal. And as you were saying that, James Cone was echoing in my mind. There is no universalism that is not particular. And I think, do you remember in the Parr exhibition, the portraits, there's kind of backs of heads. So it just shows the back of somebody's head, a male, female, a young person. And in one sense, kind of, it is very particular. It is a head, and yet it could be anybody's. And I think, you know, kind of he is playing with that idea in those photographs.
One thing you had mentioned a little bit earlier, and maybe we could talk a little bit as we try to wrap our time up together, how you've used Parr's work in class on sacramental theology to me is really interesting. You've mentioned that you took the class over. Can you talk a little bit about what that was like and how you were able to see these photographs as a sort of pedagogical tool in terms of sacramental theology?
Well, again, in the broader sense of sacrament, that, you know, every human experience, every happening, every moment has the possibility to make God known to us. And ultimately, that's what sacraments are, signs and instruments of God's compassion, of God's mercy, of God's love among us. And so one of the things that we have been looking at during this course is that, you know, how do we see God? You know, kind of very few of us have the experience of St. Paul on the road to Damascus, where this big white light knocks him from his, as the artist will suggest, knocks him from his horse or his pony, and he sees the Lord God. I'm inclined to think that, you know, kind of that the light of God is diffracted, is dappled. Okay, so all of experience, all of creation, and I just love that image of, say, of the beam of white light that passes through a prism, and is diffracted into its constitutive colors. So when people are trying to, if you like, discern the presence of God in their lives, it's not the white beam they're going to see, but it's going to be the red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, and violet of the diffraction. And again, I think part of, you know, of living sacramentally is looking at these colours and seeing them as participating in the, if you like, that extraordinary beam of light that we believe God is. God is light, okay? And so it's almost kind of a reverse approach, if you like, kind of, and instead of, you know, kind of seeing the beam first and then the presence beyond, it's almost gathering the colours of God's presence in our world and seeing them as belonging to this brighter light. So again, so that is kind of an overarching theme we have in this class. And, you know, kind of again, if we are true to our Jesuit institution here, seeing God in all things, okay? And that is kind of ultimately a sacramental worldview.
That was beautiful. It really... it's really impactful to think of, you know, photography within that sacramental realm. And as you were speaking, it really just brought to my mind what is a photograph, right? A photograph is an attempt, right? It's an attempt to make the invisible visible. So to think of sort of Augustine's original definition of, you know, the sacraments as visible realities that make present that which is invisible. It brings us to a space and time that might be past, but through these photographs can really bring back that the presence of those individuals who were there, or, you know, in the case of this particular work, the presence of the divine operative within the Catholic liturgy, which I think is really powerful. In my own class, The Challenge of Justice, I've invited the students to think about the works of Parr from the question of justice. So over the course of the semester, the way we set up this class is, in the first half, we look at a lot of the major theoretical conceptions of justice in the Western tradition. And then in the second part of the semester, we grapple with what are the challenges to creating a just society. So one of the things that I invited the students to do is to look at Parr's attentiveness to, the middle class. Sort of like the everyday person and how they experience life, and to raise questions about consumerism and consumption, and to raise questions about our care for the natural environment, and ultimately for the students to select one of these works that they felt really resonated with them, and to try to talk about how they felt, the piece of art as sort of cultural production gives voice to some of these challenges of justice that we looked at in a much more theoretical way in the first part of the semester. So it's been a great opportunity for me as a theological ethicist to have this exhibit here at Boston College and be able to bring the students into the classroom, the students from the classroom to see these works and think about what we do in a very different light. So I've been really excited to have this opportunity as well.
And perhaps as towards a closing comment for me, a photograph is an instant. It captures a moment. And sacramentally, I like to think that every moment, every incident has the capacity to communicate something of God and of the mercy and compassion of God.
That concludes this episode of Art in Focus. Thank you for listening, and be sure to visit The Terrace, the McMullen Student Publications page, to find more episodes in the series. This episode was produced by Rachel Brody, the McMullen Graduate Assistant and a doctoral candidate in the History Department. It was mixed and edited by Megan Minahan. Thanks to Rachel Chamberlain, the McMullen Manager of Education, and members of our digital team, Caitlin Park and Sasha Wong.